Chapter 15.
For a while, I watch the line ahead of me. As usual, the gaps are widening. I shake my head. If I can't even deal with this in a simple hike, how am I going to deal with it in the plant? What went wrong back there? Why didn't the balance model work? For about an hour or so, I keep thinking about what happened. Twice, I have to stop the troop to let us catch up. Sometime after the second stop, I fairly well sorted out what happened. There was no reserve. When the kids downstream in the balanced model got behind, they had no extra capacity to make up for the loss. And as the negative deviations accumulated, they got deeper and deeper in the hole. Then a long-lost memory from way back in some math class in school comes to mind. It has to do with something called a covariance, the impact of one variable upon others in the same group. A mathematical principle says that in a linear dependency of two or more variables, the fluctuations of the variables down the line will fluctuate around the maximum deviation established by any preceding variables. That explains what happened in the balanced model. Fine, but what do I do about it? On the trail, when I see how far behind we are, I can tell everyone to hurry up, or I can tell Ron to slow down or stop, and we close ranks. Inside a plant, when the departments get behind and work-in-process inventory starts building up, people are shifted around, they're put on overtime, managers start to crack the whip, product moves out the door, and inventories slowly go down again. Yeah, that's it. We run to catch up. We always run, never stop. The other option, having some workers idle, is taboo. So why can't we catch up at my plant? It feels like we're always running. We're running so hard, we're out of breath. I look up the trail. Not only are the gaps still occurring, but they're expanding faster than ever. Then I notice something weird. Nobody in the column is stuck on the heels of anybody else, except me. I'm stuck behind Herbie. Herbie? What's he doing back here? I lean to the side so I can see the line better. Ron is no longer leading the troop. He's a third of the way back now, and Davy is ahead of him. I don't know who's leading. I can't see that far. Well, son of a gun, the little bastards changed their marching order on me. Herbie, how come you're all the way back here?
Oh, hi, Mr. Rogo. I just thought I'd stay back here with you. This way I won't hold anybody up.
He's walking backwards as he's saying this. Well, that's thoughtful of you, but watch out! Herbie trips on a tree root and goes flying onto his backside. I help him up. Are you okay?
Yeah, but I guess I better walk forwards, huh? Kind of hard to talk that way, though.
That's okay, Herbie. You just enjoy the hike. I've got lots to think about. And that's no lie. Because I think Herbie may have just put me onto something. My guess is that Herbie, unless he's trying very hard, as he was before lunch, is the slowest one in the troop. I mean, he seems like a good kid and everything. He's clearly very conscientious. But he's slower than all the others. Somebody's got to be, right? So when Herbie is walking at what I'll loosely call his optimal pace, a pace that's comfortable to him, he's going to be moving slower than anybody who happens to be behind him, like me. At the moment, Herbie isn't limiting the progress of anyone except me. In fact, all the boys have arranged themselves, deliberately or accidentally, I'm not sure which, in an order that allows every one of them to walk without restriction. As I look up the line, I can't see anybody who's being held back by anybody else. The order in which they've put themselves has placed the fastest kid at the front of the line and the slowest at the back of the line. In effect, each of them, like Herbie, has found an optimal pace for himself. If this were my plant, it would be as if there were a never-ending supply of work. No idle time. But look at what's happening. The length of the line is spreading farther and faster than ever before. The gaps between the boys are widening. The closer to the front of the line, the wider the gaps become, and the faster they expand. You can look at it this way, too. Herbie is advancing at his own speed, which happens to be slower than my potential speed. But because of dependency, my maximum speed is the rate at which Herbie is walking. My rate is throughput. Herbie's rate governs mine, so Herbie really is determining the maximum throughput. My head feels as though it's going to take off. Because, see, it really doesn't matter how fast any one of us can go or does go. Somebody up there, whoever is leading right now, is walking faster than average, say 3 miles per hour. So what? Is his speed helping the troop as a whole to move faster, to gain more throughput? No way! Each of the other boys down the line is walking a little bit faster than the kid directly behind him. Are any of them helping to move the troop faster? Absolutely not. Herbie is walking at his own slower speed. He is the one who is governing throughput for the troop as a whole. In fact, whoever is moving the slowest in the troop is the one who will govern throughput. And that person may not always be Herbie. Before lunch, Herbie was walking faster. It really wasn't obvious who was the slowest in the troop. So the role of Herbie, the greatest limit on throughput, was actually floating through the troop. It depended upon who was moving the slowest at a particular time. But overall, Herbie has the least capacity for walking. His rate ultimately determines the troop's rate, which means...
Hey, look at this, Mr. Rogo.
He's pointing at a marker made of concrete next to the trail. I take a look. Well, I'll be. It's a milestone. A genuine, honest-to-God milestone. How many speeches have I heard where somebody talks about these damn things? And this is the first one I've ever come across. It says 5 miles. It must mean there are 5 miles to walk in both directions. So this must be the midpoint of the hike. 5 miles to go. What time is it? I check my watch. Gee, it's 2:30 p.m. already. And we left at 8:30 a.m. So, subtracting the hour we took for lunch, that means we've covered 5 miles. In 5 hours? We aren't moving at 2 miles per hour. We're moving at the rate of 1 mile per hour. So, with 5 hours to go, it's going to be dark by the time we get there. And Herbie is standing here next to me, delaying the throughput of the entire troop. Okay, let's go! Let's go!
All right!
What am I going to do? Rogo, I'm telling myself in my head, you loser. You can't even manage a troop of Boy Scouts. Up front, you've got some kid who wants to set a speed record, and here you are stuck behind Fat Herbie, the slowest kid in the woods. After an hour, the kid in front, if he's really moving at 3 miles per hour, is going to be 2 miles ahead, which means you're going to have to run 2 miles to catch up with him. If this were my plant, Peach wouldn't even give me 3 months. I'd already be on the street by now. The demand was for us to cover 10 miles in 5 hours, and we've only done half of that. Inventory is racing out of sight. The carrying cost on that inventory would be rising. We'd be ruining the company. But there really isn't much I can do about Herbie. Maybe I could put him someplace else in the line, but he's not going to move any faster, so it wouldn't make any difference. Or would it? Hey, tell the kid at the front to stop where he is!
Wait, stop, Speedy!
The boys relay the call up to the front of the column. Everybody stay in line until we catch up. Don't lose your place in the line. 15 minutes later, the troop is standing in condensed line. I find that Andy is the one who usurped the role of leader. I remind them all to stay in exactly the same place they had when we were walking. Okay, everybody join hands. They all look at each other. Come on, just do it, and don't let go. Then I take Herbie by the hand, and as if I'm dragging a chain, I go up the trail, snaking past the entire line. Hand in hand, the rest of the troop follows. I pass Andy and keep walking, and when I'm twice the distance of the lineup, I stop. What I've done is turn the entire troop around so that the boys have exactly the opposite order they had before. Now listen up. This is the order you're going to stay in until we reach where we're going. Understood? Nobody passes anybody. Everybody just tries to keep up with the person in front of him. Herbie will lead.
Me?
Everyone else looks aghast.
You want him to lead?
But he's the slowest one.
The idea of this hike is not to see who can get there the fastest. The idea is to get there together. We're not a bunch of individuals out here. We're a team. And the team does not arrive in camp until all of us arrive in camp. So we start off again. And it works. No kidding. Everybody stays together behind Herbie. I've gone to the back of the line so I can keep tabs. And I keep waiting for the gaps to appear, but they don't. In the middle of the line, I see someone pause to adjust his pack straps. But as soon as he starts again, we all walk just a little faster, and we're caught up. Nobody's out of breath. What a difference. Of course, it isn't long before the fast kids in the back of the line start their grumbling.
Hey, Herbies, I'm going to sleep back here. Can't you speed it up a little?
He's doing the
he can, so lay off him.
Mr. Rogo, can't we put somebody faster in front?
Listen, if you guys want to go faster, then you have to figure out a way to let Herbie go faster. It gets quiet for a few minutes. Then one of the kids in the rear yells out,
"Hey, Herbie, what have you got in your pack?"
"None of your business."
"Okay, let's hold up for a minute." Herbie stops and turns around. I tell him to come to the back of the line and take off his pack. As he does, I take the pack from him and nearly drop it. "Herbie, this thing weighs a ton. What have you got in here?"
"Nothing much."
I open it up and reach in. Out comes a six-pack of soda. Next are some cans of spaghetti. Then come a box of candy bars, a jar of pickles, and two cans of tuna fish. Beneath a raincoat and rubber boots and a bag of tent steaks, I pull out a large iron skillet. And off to the side is an army surplus collapsible steel shovel. "Herbie, why did you ever decide to bring all this along?"
"We're supposed to be prepared, you know."
"Okay, let's divide this stuff up."
"I can carry it."
"Herbie, look, you've done a great job of lugging this stuff so far, but we have to make you able to move faster. If we take some of the load off you, you'll be able to do a better job at the front of the line." Herbie finally seems to understand. Andy takes the iron skillet, and a few of the others pick up a couple of the items I've pulled out of the pack. I take most of it and put it into my own pack, because I'm the biggest. Herbie goes back to the head of the line. Again we start walking, but this time Herbie can really move. Relieved of most of the weight in his pack, it's as if he's walking on air. We're flying now, doing twice the speed as a troop that we did before, and we still stay together. Inventory is down. Throughput is up. Devil's Gulch is lovely in the late afternoon sun. Down in what appears to be the gulch, the Rampage River goes creaming past boulders and outcroppings of rock. Golden rays of sunlight shift through the trees. Birds are tweeting. And off in the distance is the unmistakable melody of high-speed automobile traffic.
Look! There's a shopping center out there.
Does it have a Burger King?
Hey, this isn't the wilderness.
They just don't make wildernesses like they used to. Look, we'll have to settle for what we've got. Let's make camp. The time is now 5 o'clock. This means that after relieving Herbie of his pack, we covered about 4 miles in 2 hours. Herbie was the key to controlling the entire troop. Tents are erected. A spaghetti dinner is prepared by Dave and Evan. Feeling somewhat guilty because I set up the rules that drove them into their servitude, I give them a hand with cleaning up afterwards. Dave and I share the same tent that night. We're lying inside it, both of us tired. Dave is quiet for a while. Then he speaks up.
"You know, Dad, I was really proud of you today."
"You were? How come?"
"The way you figured out what was going on and kept everyone together and put Herbie in front, we'd probably have been on that trail forever if it hadn't been for you. None of the other guys' parents took any responsibility for anything, but you did."
"Thanks. Actually, I learned a lot of things today."
"You did?"
"Yeah. Stuff that I think is going to help me straighten out the plant."
"Really? Like what?"
"You sure you want to hear about it?"
"Sure I am."
We're awake for some time talking about everything. He hangs in there, even asks some questions. By the time we're finished, all we can hear is some snoring from the other tents, a few crickets, and the squealing tires of some idiot turning donuts out there on the highway.
Chapter 16.
Davy and I get home around 4:30 on Sunday afternoon. Both of us are tired, but we're feeling pretty good in spite of the miles. After I pull into the driveway, Dave hops out to open the garage door. I ease the Buick in and go around to open the trunk so we can get our packs.
"I wonder where Mom went."
I look over and notice that her car is gone. She's probably out shopping or something. Inside, Dave stows the camping gear while I go into the bedroom to change clothes. A hot shower is going to feel absolutely terrific. After I wash off the great outdoors, I'm thinking maybe I'll take everybody out to dinner, get us a good meal as kind of a celebration of the triumphant return of father and son. A closet door is open in the bedroom. When I reach to shut it, I see that most of Julie's clothes are gone. I stand there for a minute, looking at the empty space. Dave comes up behind me.
"Dad?"
I turn.
"This was left on the kitchen table. I guess Mom left it."
He hands me a sealed envelope. "Thanks, Dave." I wait until he's gone to open it. Inside is just a short, handwritten note. It says, "Al, I can't handle always being last in line for you. I need more of you, and it's clear now that you won't change. I'm going away for a while. Need to think things over. Sorry to do this to you. I know you're busy. Yours truly, Julie. P.S. I left Sharon with your mother. When I'm able to move, I put the note in my pocket and go find Davy. I tell him I have to go across town and pick up Sharon, and that he's to stay here. If his mother calls, he's to ask her where she's calling from and get a number where I can call her back. He wants to know if something is wrong. I tell him not to worry and promise to explain when I get back. I go rocketing to my mother's house. When she opens the door, she starts talking about Julie before I can even say hello.
Alex, do you know your wife did the strangest thing? I was making lunch yesterday when the doorbell rang. And when I opened the door, Sharon was standing there on the step with her little suitcase. And your wife was in the car at the curb there. But she wouldn't get out. And when I went down to talk to her, she drove away.
By now, I'm in the door. Sharon runs to greet me from the living room where she's watching television. I pick her up and she gives me a long hug. My mother is still talking.
What on earth could be wrong with her?
We'll talk about it later.
I just don't understand what...
Later, okay? Then I look at Sharon. Her face is rigid. Her eyes are frozen big. She's terrified. So, did you have a nice visit with Grandma? She nods but doesn't say anything. What do you say we go home now? She looks down at the floor. Don't you want to go home? She shrugs her shoulders.
Do you like it here with Grandma?
Sharon starts to cry. I get her and her suitcase into the car. We start home. After I've driven a couple of blocks, I look over at her. She's like a little statue, sitting there, staring straight ahead with her red eyes focused on the top of the dashboard. At the next stoplight, I reach over for her and pull her next to me. She's very quiet for a while, but then she finally looks up at me.
Is Mommy still mad at me?
Mad at you? She isn't mad at you.
Yes, she is. She wouldn't talk to me.
Oh, Sharon, your mother isn't upset with you. You didn't do anything wrong.
Then why?
Why don't we wait until we get home? I'll explain it to both you and your brother then. I think that explaining the situation to both of the kids at the same time turns out to be easier on me than on them. I've always been reasonably adept at maintaining the outward illusion of control in the midst of chaos. I tell them Julie has simply gone away for a little while, maybe only a day or so. She'll be back. She just has to get over a few things that are upsetting and confusing her. I give them all the standard reassurances. Your mom still loves you. I still love you. There was nothing either of you could have done. Everything will work out for the best. For the most part, both of them sit there like little rocks. Maybe they're reflecting back what I'm giving them. We go out and get pizza for dinner. That normally would be kind of a fun thing. Tonight, it's very quiet. Nobody has anything to say. We mechanically chew and then leave. When we get back, I make both of the kids do homework for school. I don't know if they do it or not. I go to the phone, and after a long debate with myself, I try to make a couple of calls. Julie doesn't have any friends in Barrington, none that I know of, so it would be useless to try to call the neighbors. They wouldn't know anything, and the story about us having problems would spread instantly. Instead, I try calling Jane, the friend from the last place we lived, the one whom Julie claimed to have spent the night with last Thursday. There is no answer at Jane's. So then, I try Julie's parents. I get her father on the phone. After some small talk about the weather and the kids, it's clear he isn't going to make any declarations. I conclude that her parents don't know what's going on. But before I can think of a casual way to end the call and avoid the explanations, her old man asks me,
"So, is Julie going to talk to us?"
Well, that's actually why I was calling.
Oh? Nothing's wrong, I hope.
I'm afraid there is. She left yesterday while I was on a camping trip with Dave. I was wondering if you'd heard from her. Immediately, he's spreading the alarm to Julie's mother. She gets on the phone.
Why did she leave?
I don't know.
Well, I know the daughter we raised, and she wouldn't just leave without a very good reason.
She just left me a note saying she had to get away for a while.
What did you do to her?
Nothing! Then her father gets back on the phone and asks if I've talked to the police. He suggests that maybe she was kidnapped. I tell him that's highly unlikely, because my mother saw her drive away and nobody had a gun to her head. Finally, I say, if you hear from her, would you please have her give me a call? I'm very worried about her. An hour later, I do call the police.
But as I expected, they won't help unless I have some evidence that something criminal has taken place. I go and put the kids to bed. Sometime after midnight, I'm staring at the dark bedroom ceiling, and I hear a car turning into the driveway. I leap out of bed and run to the window. By the time I get there, the headlights are arcing back toward the street. It was just a stranger turning around. The car drives away.
Chapter 17.
Monday morning is a disaster. It starts with Davy trying to make breakfast for himself and Sharon and me, which is a nice, responsible thing to do, but he totally screws it up. While I'm in the shower, he attempts pancakes. I'm midway through shaving when I hear the fight from the kitchen. I rush down to find Dave and Sharon pushing each other. There's a skillet on the floor with lumps of batter, black on one side and raw on the other, splattered. Hey, what's going on?
It's all her fault!
You were burning them.
I was not!
Smoke is fuming off the stove where something spilled. I step over to shut it off.
I was just trying to help, but he wouldn't let me. Even I know how to make pancakes.
Okay, because both of you want to help, you can help clean up. When everything is back in some semblance of order, I feed them cold cereal. We eat another meal in silence. With all the disruption and delay, Sharon misses her school bus. I get Davy out the door and go looking for her so I can drive her to school. She's lying down on her bed. Ready whenever you are, Ms. Rogo.
I can't go to school.
Why not?
I'm sick.
Sharon, you have to go to school.
But I'm sick.
I go sit down on the edge of the bed. I know you're upset. I am too. But these are the facts. I have to go to work. I can't stay home with you. And I won't leave you here by yourself. You can go to your grandmother's house for the day, or you can go to school. She sits up. I put my arm around her.
I guess I'll go to school.
I give her a squeeze and say, attaway, kid. I knew you'd do the right thing. By the time I get both kids to school and myself to work, it's past 9 o'clock. As I walk in, Fran waves a message slip at me. I grab it and read it. It's from Hilton Smythe, marked urgent and double underlined. I call him.
Well, it's about time. I tried to reach you an hour ago.
What's the problem, Hilton?
Your people are sitting on 100 sub-assemblies I need.
Hilton, we're not sitting on anything.
Then why aren't they here? I've got a customer order we can't ship because your people dropped the ball.
Just give me the particulars and I'll have somebody look into it. He gives some reference numbers and I write them down. Okay, I'll have somebody get back to you.
You'd better do more than that, pal. You'd better make sure we get those sub-assemblies by the end of the day. And I mean all 100 pieces. Not 87, not 99, but all of them. Because I'm not going to have my people do 2 setups for final assembly on account of your lateness.
Look, we'll do our best, but I'm not going to make any promises.
Oh, well, let's just put it this way. If we don't get 100 sub-assemblies from you today, I'm talking to Peach. And from what I hear, you're in enough trouble with him already.
Listen, pal, my status with Bill Peach is none of your damn business. What makes you think you can threaten me?
Maybe you ought to read your mail.
What do you mean by that? I can hear him smiling.
Just get me the sub-assemblies by the end of the day. Bye-bye.
I hang up. Weird. I talk to Fran. She calls Bob Donovan for me and then notifies the staff that there will be a meeting at 10 o'clock. Donovan comes in, and I ask him to have an expediter see what's holding up the job for Smythe's plant. Almost gritting my teeth as I say it, I tell him to make sure the sub-assemblies go out today. After he's gone, I try to forget about the call, but I can't. Finally, I go ask Fran if anything has come in recently that mentions Hilton Smythe. She thinks for a minute, then reaches for a folder.
This memo just came in on Friday. It looks like Mr. Smythe got a promotion.
I take the memo she hands me. It's from Bill Peach. It's an announcement that he's named Smythe to the newly created position of Division Productivity Manager. The appointment is effective at the end of this week. The job description says all plant managers will now report on a dotted line to Smythe, who will give special attention to manufacturing productivity improvement with emphasis on cost reduction. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Whatever enthusiasm I expected from the staff with regard to my education over the weekend, well, I don't get it. Maybe I thought all I had to do was walk in and open my mouth to reveal my discoveries, and they'd all be instantly converted by the obvious rightness. But it doesn't work that way. We, Lou, Bob, Stacy, and Ralph Nakamura, who runs data processing for the plant, are in the conference room. I'm standing in front next to an easel which holds a big pad of paper, sheet after sheet of which is covered with little diagrams I've drawn during my explanations. I've invested a couple of hours making those explanations, but now it's almost time for lunch, and they're all just sitting there unimpressed. Looking down the table at the faces looking back at me, I can see they don't know what to make of what I've told them. Okay, I think I see a faint glimmer of understanding in Stacy's eyes. Bob Donovan is on the fence. He seems to have intuitively grasped some of it. Ralph is not sure what it is I'm really saying, and Lou is frowning at me. One sympathizer, one undecided, one bewildered, and one skeptic. Okay, what's the problem? They glance at each other. Come on. This is like I just proved 2 and 2 equals 4, and you don't believe me. Lou, what's the problem you're having?
I don't know, Al. It's just that, well, you said how you figured this out by watching a bunch of kids on a hike in the woods.
So? What's wrong with that?
Nothing, but how do you know these things are really going on out there in the plant?
I flip back a few sheets on the easel until I find the one with the names of Jonas 2 phenomena written on it. Look at this. Do we have statistical fluctuations in our operations?
Yes, we do.
And do we have dependent events in our plant?
Yes.
Then what I've told you has to be right.
Now, hold on a minute. Robots don't have statistical fluctuations. They always work at the same pace. That's one of the reasons we bought the damn things. Consistency. And I thought the main reason you went to see this Jonah guy was to find out what to do about the robot.
It's okay to say that fluctuations in cycle time for a robot would be almost flat while it was working. But we're not dealing just with robotic operation. Our other operations do have both phenomena. And remember, the goal isn't to make the robots productive. It's to make the whole system productive. Isn't that right, Lou?
Well, Bob may have a point. We've got a lot of automated equipment out there, and the process times ought to be fairly consistent.
But what he's saying is...
Just then, the conference room door opens. Fred, one of our expediters, puts his head into the room and looks at Bob Donovan.
May I see you for a second? It's about the job for Hilton Smythe.
Bob stands up to leave the room, but I tell Fred to come in. Like it or not, I have to be interested in what's happening on this crisis for Hilton Smythe. Fred explains that the job has to go through 2 more departments before the sub-assemblies are complete and ready for shipment. Can we get them out today?
It's going to be close, but we can try. The truck shuttle leaves at 5 o'clock.
The shuttle is a private trucking service that all the plants in the division use to move parts back and forth.
5 o'clock's the last run of the day that we can use to reach Smythe's plant. If we don't make that trip, the next shuttle won't be until tomorrow afternoon.
What has to be done?
Peter Schnell's department has to do some fabricating. Then the pieces have to be welded. We're going to set up one of the robots to do the welds.
Ah, yes, the robots. You think we can do it?
According to the quotas, Pete's people are supposed to give us the parts for 25 units every hour. And I know the robot is capable of welding 25 units of this subassembly per hour.
Bob asks about moving the pieces to the robot. In a normal situation, the pieces finished by Pete's people probably would be moved to the robot only once a day, or maybe not until the entire batch was finished. We can't wait that long. The robot has to begin its work as soon as possible.
I'll make arrangements to have a materials handler stop at Pete's department every hour on the hour.
Okay. How soon can Pete start?
Pete can start on the job at noon, so we've got 5 hours.
You know that Pete's people quit at 4.
Yeah, I told you it's going to be close. But all we can do is try. That's what you want, isn't it?
You people don't really know what to make of what I told you this morning. But if what I've told you is correct, then we should be able to see the effects occurring out there, on the floor. Am I right? And if we know that Jonah is correct, we'd be pretty stupid to continue running the plant the same way as before, right? So I'm going to let you see for yourselves what's happening. You say Pete's going to start on this at noon?
Right. Everyone in that department is at lunch now. They went at 11:30, so they'll start at 12. And the robot will be set up by 1 o'clock when the materials handler will make the first transfer.
I take some paper and a pencil and start sketching a simple schedule. The output has to be 100 pieces by 5 o'clock, no less than that. Hilton says he won't accept a partial shipment. So if we can't do the whole job, then I don't want us to ship anything. Now, Pete's people are supposed to produce at the rate of 25 pieces per hour. But that doesn't mean they'll always have 25 at the end of every hour. Sometimes there'll be a few pieces short. Sometimes there'll be a few ahead. I look around. Everyone is with me. So we've got statistical fluctuations going on. But we're planning that from noon until 4 o'clock. Pete's department should have averaged an output of 100 pieces. The robot, on the other hand, is supposed to be more precise in its output. It will be set up to work at the rate of 25 pieces per hour. No more, no less. We also have dependent events, because the robot cannot begin its welding until the materials handler has delivered the pieces from Pete's department. The robot can't start until 1 o'clock. But by 5 o'clock, when the truck is ready to leave, we want to be loading the last piece into the back.
I show them the finished schedule. Okay, I want Pete to keep a log of exactly how many parts are actually completed by his department hour by hour. And I want Fred to keep the same type of log for the robot. And remember, no cheating. We need the real numbers, okay?
Sure, no problem.
By the way, do you actually think we'll be able to ship 100 pieces today?
Well, I guess it's up to Pete. If he says he can do it, I don't see why not.
Tell you what, I'll bet you $10 we don't ship today.
You serious?
Sure I am.
Okay, you're on. $10.
While everyone else is at lunch, I call Hilton Smythe. Hilton is at lunch as well, but I leave a message for him. I tell his secretary the sub-assemblies will definitely arrive at his plant tomorrow, but that's the best we can do, unless Hilton wants to pay for a special shipment tonight. Knowing his concern for holding down costs, I'm sure Hilton won't want to shell out anything extra. After that call, I sit back and try to think about my marriage and what to do. Obviously, there's been no news from Julie. I'm mad as hell that she took off. I'm also very worried about her, but what can I do? I can't cruise the streets looking for her. She could be anywhere. I just have to be patient. Eventually, I should hear from her, or her lawyer. Meanwhile, there are two kids who have to be taken care of. Well, for all practical purposes, we'd better make that three kids. Fran comes into my office with another message slip.
One of the other secretaries just gave me this as I got back from lunch. While you were on the phone, you got a call from David Rogo. Is that your son?
Yes. What's the problem?
It says here he's worried he won't be able to get into the house after school. Is your wife gone?
Yeah, she's out of town for a few days. Fran, you've got a couple of kids. How do you manage to hold a job and take care of them?
Well, tain't easy. On the other hand, I don't work the long hours you do. If I were you, I'd get some help until she gets back.
When she leaves, I pick up the phone again. Hello, Mom. It's Alex.
Have you heard from Julie yet?
No, I haven't. Listen, Mom, would you mind staying with me and the kids until Julie gets back? At 2 o'clock, I slip out to pick up my mother and take her to the house before the kids get home from school. When I arrive at her house, she's at the door with two suitcases and four cardboard boxes filled with half of her kitchen. Mom, we've already got pots and pans at my house.
They're just not the same as mine.
So, we load the trunk. I take her and her pots and pans over to the house and unload. She waits for the kids to come home from school, and I race back to the plant. Around 4 o'clock, at the end of the first shift, I go down to Bob Donovan's office to find out what the story is on Smythe's shipment. He's waiting for me.
Well, 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 good afternoon. How nice of you to drop by.
What are you so happy about?
Hey, I'm always happy when people who owe me money drop by.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
What makes you think anybody owes you money? Bob holds out his hand and wiggles his fingers.
Come on, come on. Don't tell me you forgot about the bet we made. $10, remember? I just talked to Pete, and his people are indeed going to finish the 100 units of parts. So the robot should have no problem finishing that shipment for Smythe's plant.
Yeah? Well, if that's true, I won't mind losing.
So you concede defeat?
No way. Not until those sub-assemblies get on the 5 o'clock truck.
Hey, suit yourself.
Let's go see what's really going on out there. We take a walk out on the floor to Pete's office. Before we get there, we pass the robot, who's brightening the area with its weld flashes. Coming the other way are two guys. Just as they pass the welding area, they stop and give a little cheer.
We beat the robot!
Must be from Pete's department.
We smile as we pass them. They didn't really beat anything, of course, but what the hell. They look happy. Bob and I continue to Pete's office, which is a little steel-sided shack among the machines.
Hello there. Hey, we got that rush job done for you today.
Good, Pete, but do you have that log sheet you were supposed to keep?
Yes, I do. Where did I put it?
He sorts through the papers on his desk, talking as he hunts for it.
You should have seen my people this afternoon. I mean, they really moved. I went around and told them how important this shipment is. And they really put themselves into it. You know how things usually slow down at the end of the shift? Well, today they hustled. They were proud when they walked out of here today.
Yeah, we noticed.
There you are.
We read it. Okay, so you only got 19 pieces done in the first hour.
Well, it took us a little longer to get organized, and one guy was late coming back from lunch. But at 1 o'clock, we had a materials handler take the 19 over to the robot so it could get started.
Then, from 1 to 2, you still missed the quota by 4 pieces.
Yeah, but so what? I mean, look what happened from 2 to 3 o'clock. We beat the quota by 3 pieces. Then I saw we were still behind. I went around and told everybody how important it was for us to get those 100 pieces done by the end of the shift.
So everyone went a little faster.
Yeah, that's right. And we made up for the slow start.
Yeah, 32 pieces in the last hour. So what do you say, Al?
Let's go see what's happening with the robot. At 5 minutes past 5 o'clock, the robot is still turning out welded sub-assemblies. Donovan is pacing. Fred walks up.
Is that truck going to wait?
I asked the driver. He says he can't. He's got other stops to make, and if he waits for us, he'll be late all night.
Well, what the heck is wrong with this stupid robot? It's got all the parts it needs.
I tap him on the shoulder. Here, look at this. I show him the sheet of paper on which Fred has been recording the output of the robot. From my shirt pocket, I take out Pete's log and fold the bottom of it so we can put the two pieces of paper together. You see, the first hour, Pete's people did 19 pieces. The robot was capable of doing 25, but Pete delivered less than that. So 19 became the robot's true capacity for that hour.
Same with the second hour. Pete delivered 21, the robot can only do 21.
Every time Pete's area got behind, it was passed on to the robot. But when Pete delivered 28 pieces, the robot could still only do 25. That meant that when the final delivery of 32 pieces arrived at 4 o'clock, the robot still had 3 pieces to work on from the last batch, so it couldn't start on the final batch right away.
Okay, I see now.
You know, the most Pete was ever behind was 10 pieces. Kind of funny how that's exactly the number of pieces we ended up short.
That's the effect of the mathematical principle I was trying to explain this morning. The maximum deviation of a preceding operation will become the starting point of a subsequent operation. Bob reaches for his wallet.
Well, I guess I owe you $10.
Tell you what, instead of paying me, why don't you give the money to Pete so he can spring for a round of coffee or something for the people in his department? Just a little way to say thanks for the extra effort this afternoon.
Yeah, right. That's a good idea. Listen, sorry we couldn't ship today. Hope it doesn't get us in trouble.
We can't worry about that now. The gain we made today is that we learned something. But I'll tell you one thing. We've got to take a close look at our incentives here.
How come?
Don't you see? It didn't matter that Pete got his 100 pieces done, because we still couldn't ship. But Pete and his people thought they were heroes. Ordinarily, we might have thought the same thing. That isn't right.
Chapter 18.
When I get home that evening, both of the kids greet me at the door. My mother is in the background with steam pouring out of the kitchen. I presume it has something to do with dinner and that she has everything under control. In front of me, Sharon's face is beaming up at me.
Guess what?
I give up.
Mommy called on the phone.
She did? I glance at my mother. She shakes her head.
Davy answered the phone. I didn't talk to her.
So what did Mommy say?
She said she loved Davy and me. And she said she would be away for a while, but not to worry about her.
Did she say when she'd be coming back?
I asked her that, but she said she couldn't say right now.
Did you get a phone number so I can call her back? David, you were supposed to ask her for the number if she called.
I did, but she didn't want to give it to me.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, Dad.
It's all right, Dave. Thanks for trying.
Why don't we all sit down to dinner?
This time, the meal is not silent. My mother talks, and she does her best to cheer us up. She tells us stories about the Depression and how lucky we are to have food to eat. Tuesday morning is a little bit more normal. Joining efforts, my mother and I manage to get the kids to school and me to work on time. By 8:30, Bob, Stacy, Lou, and Ralph are in my office, and we're talking about what happened yesterday. Today, I find them much more attentive. Maybe it's because they've seen the proof of the idea take place on their own turf, so to speak. This combination of dependency and fluctuations is what we're up against every day. I think it explains why we have so many late orders. Lou and Ralph are examining the two charts we made yesterday.
What would have happened if the second operation hadn't been a robot, if it had been some kind of job with people?
We would have had another set of statistical fluctuations to complicate things. Don't forget, we only had two operations here. You can imagine what happens when we've got dependency running through 10 or 15 operations, each with its own set of fluctuations, just to make one part. And some of our products involve hundreds of parts.
Then how can we ever control what's going on out there?
That's the billion-dollar question. How can we control the 50,000, or who knows, maybe it's 50 million variables which exist in this plant?
We'd have to buy a new mainframe computer just to keep track of all of them.
A new computer wouldn't save us. Data management alone isn't going to give us more control.
Well, what about longer lead times?
Oh, you really think longer lead time would have guaranteed our ability to ship that order to Hilton Smythe's plant? How long had we already known about that order before yesterday, Bob?
Hey, all I'm saying is that we'd have some slop in there to make up for the delays.
Longer lead times increase inventory, Bob, and that isn't the goal.
Okay, I know that. I'm not fighting you. The only reason I mention the lead times is that I want to know what we do about all this.
Everybody turns to me. This much is clear to me. We have to change the way we think about production capacity. We cannot measure the capacity of a resource in isolation. Its true productive capacity depends upon where it is in the plant, and trying to level capacity with demand to minimize expenses has really screwed us up. We shouldn't be trying to do that at all.
But that's what everybody else does.
Yes, everybody does, or claims to. As we now can see, it's a stupid thing to try.
So how do other manufacturers survive?
I tell him I was wondering that myself. What I suspect is that as a plant comes close to being balanced through the efforts of engineers and managers doing the wrong things, events head toward a crisis, and the plant is very quickly unbalanced by shifting workers or by overtime or by calling back some people from layoff. The survival incentive overrides false beliefs.
Okay, but again, what are we going to do? We can't hire without division approval, and we've even got a policy against overtime.
Maybe it's time to call Jonah again.
I think maybe you're right. It takes Fran half an hour to locate the area of the world where Jonah happens to be today, and another hour passes before Jonah can get to the phone to talk to us. As soon as he's on the line, I have another secretary round up the staff again and corral them in my office so we can hear him on a speakerphone. While they're coming in, I tell Jonah about the hike with Herbie, where I discovered the meaning of what he was telling me and what we've learned about the effects of the two phenomena in the plant. What we know now is that we shouldn't be looking at each local area and trying to trim it. We should be trying to optimize the whole system. Some resources have to have more capacity than others. The ones at the end of the line should have more than the ones at the beginning. Sometimes a lot more. Am I right?
You're on the money.
Good. Glad to hear we're getting somewhere. Only the reason I called is we need to know where to go from here.
What you have to do next, Alex, is distinguish between two types of resources in your plant. One type is what I call a bottleneck resource. The other is very simply a non-bottleneck resource.
Start taking notes.
A bottleneck is any resource whose capacity is equal to or less than the demand placed upon it. And a non-bottleneck is any resource whose capacity is greater than the demand placed on it. Got it?
Right.
Once you have recognized these two types of resources, you will begin to see vast implications.
But, Jonah, where does market demand come in? There has to be some relationship between demand and capacity.
Yes, but as you already know, you should not balance capacity with demand. What you need to do instead is balance the flow of product through the plant with demand from the market. This, in fact, is the first of nine rules that express the relationships between bottlenecks and non-bottlenecks and how you should manage your plant. So let me repeat it for you. Balance flow, not capacity.
I'm not sure I understand. Where do the bottlenecks and non-bottlenecks come into the picture?
Let me ask you, which of the two types of resources determines the effective capacity of the plant?
It would have to be the bottleneck.
That's right. It's like the kid on that hike last weekend, Herbie. He had the least capacity, and he was the one who actually determined how fast the troop as a whole could move.
So where should you balance the flow?
Oh, I see. The idea is to make the flow through the bottleneck equal to demand from the market.
Basically, yes, you've got it. Actually, the flow should be a tiny bit less than the demand.
How come?
Because if you keep it equal to demand and the market demand goes down, you lose money. But that's a fine point. Speaking fundamentally, the bottleneck flow should be on a par with demand.
Excuse me, but I thought bottlenecks were bad. They ought to be eliminated where possible, right?
No, bottlenecks are not necessarily bad or good. They are simply a reality. What I am suggesting is that where they exist, You must then use them to control the flow through the system and into the market.
That makes sense to me as I'm listening, because I'm remembering how I used Herbie to control the troop during the hike.
Now I have to run because you caught me during a 10-minute break in a presentation.
Jonah, before you go,
yes?
What's our next step?
Well, first of all, does your plant have any bottlenecks?
We don't know.
Then that's your next step. You have to find this out, because it makes an enormous difference in how you manage your resources.
How do we find the bottlenecks?
It's very simple, but it would take a few minutes to explain. Look, try to figure that out for yourselves. It's really easy to do if you think about it first.
Okay,
goodbye
but...
Goodbye for now. Call me when you know if you have a bottleneck.
Well, what now?
I guess we look at all our resources and compare them against market demand. If we find one in which demand is greater than capacity, then we'll know we've got a bottleneck.
What happens if we find one?
I guess the best thing to do would be what I did to the scout troop. We adjust capacity so the bottleneck is at the front of production.
My question is, what happens if our resource with the least capacity, in fact, has a capacity greater than what market demand calls for?
Then, I guess we'd have something like a bottle without a neck.
But there would still be limits. The bottle would still have walls, but they'd be greater than the market demand.
And if that's the case?
I don't know. I guess the first thing to do is find out if we've got a bottleneck.
So we go look for Herbie, if he's out there.
Yeah, quick, before we talk ourselves to death.
I walk into the conference room a few days later, and there's paper everywhere. The main table is covered with computer printouts and binders. Over in the corner, a data terminal has been installed. Next to it, a printer is churning out even more paper. The waste baskets are full. So are all the ashtrays. The litter of white styrofoam coffee cups, empty sugar packets and creamer containers, napkins, candy bar and cracker wrappers and so on is scattered about. What has happened is the place has been turned into our headquarters in the search for Herbie. We have not found him yet, and we're getting tired. Sitting at the far end of the main table is Ralph Nakamura. He and his data processing people and the system database they manage are essential to the search. Ralph does not look happy as I come in. He's running his skinny fingers through his thinning black hair.
This isn't the way it's supposed to be. Do you know what we just did?
You found Herbie?
No, we just spent 2.5 hours calculating the demand for machines that don't exist.
Why'd you do that?
Wait a minute. Let me explain. What happened was they came across some routings which still listed some of the old milling machines as being part of the processing. We don't use them anymore.
Not only don't we use them, we just found out we sold them a year ago.
Everybody down in our department knows those machines aren't there anymore, so it's never been a problem.
So it goes. We're trying to calculate demand for every resource, every piece of equipment in the plant. Jonah had said a bottleneck is any resource which is equal to or less than the market demand placed on it. To find out if we've got one then, we concluded we first would have to know the total market demand for products coming out of this plant. And second, we would have to find out how much time each resource has to contribute toward filling the demand. If the number of available hours for production, discounting maintenance time for machines, lunch and breaks for people and so on, for the resource is equal to or less than the hours demanded, then we know we've found our Herbie. Getting a fix on the total market demand is a matter of pulling together data which we have on hand anyway, the existing backlog of customer orders and the forecast for new product and spare parts. It's the complete product mix for the entire plant, including what we sell to other plants and divisions in the company. Having done that, we're now in the process of calculating the hours each work center has to contribute. We're defining a work center as any group of the same resources. 10 welders with the same skills constitute a work center. 4 identical machines constitute another. The 4 machinists who set up and run the machine are still another, and so on. Dividing the total of work center hours needed by the number of resources in it gives us the relative effort per resource, a standard we can use for comparison. Yesterday, for instance, we found the demand for injection molding machines is about 260 hours a month for all the injection molded parts that we have to process. The available time for those machines is about 280 hours per month per resource. So that means we still have reserve capacity on those machines. But the more we get into this, the more we're finding that the accuracy of our data is less than perfect. We're coming up with bills of material that don't match the routings that don't have the current runtimes or the correct machines, as we just found out.
and so on.
The problem is, we've been under the gun so much that a lot of the updating has just fallen by the wayside.
Well, with engineering changes, shifting labor around, and all that happening all the time, it's just plain tough to keep up with it no matter what.
To double-check and update every piece of data relevant to this plant could take months.
Or years.
I sit down and close my eyes for a second. When I open my eyes, they're all looking at me. Obviously, we're not going to have time for that. We've only got 10 weeks now to make something happen before Peach blows the whistle. I know we're on the right track, but we're still just limping along here. We've got to accept the fact that we're not going to have perfect data to work with.
Then I have to remind you of the old data processing aphorism. Garbage in, garbage out.
Wait a minute. Maybe we're being a little too methodical. Searching a database isn't the only way to find answers. Can't we come up with some other, faster way to isolate the bottleneck, or at least identify the candidates? When I think back to the model of the boys on the hike, it was obvious who the slower kids were on the trail. Doesn't anybody have any hunches where the Herbie might be in the plant?
But we don't even know if we've got one yet.
Bob has his hands on his hips. His mouth is half open, as if he might say something. Finally, he does.
Hell, I've been at this plant for more than 20 years. After that much time, I know where the problems usually seem to start. I think I could put together a list of areas where we might be short on capacity. At least that would narrow the focus for us. It might save some time.
You know, you just gave me an idea. If we talk to the expediters, they could probably tell us which parts they're missing most of the time and in which departments they usually go to look for them.
What good is that going to do?
The parts most frequently in short supply are probably the ones that would pass through a bottleneck. And the department where the expediters go to look for them is probably where we'll find our Herbie.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I'll tell you something I just thought of. Out on the trail, you could tell the slower kids by the gaps in the line. The slower the kid, the greater the distance between him and the kid in front of him. In terms of the analogy, those gaps were inventory.
So?
Don't you see? If we've got a Herbie, it's probably going to have a huge pile of work in process sitting in front of it.
Yeah, but we've got huge piles all over the place out there.
And we find the biggest one.
Right. That's got to be another sure sign.
What do you think, Ralph?
Well, it all sounds worth a try. Once you've narrowed the field to maybe 3 or 4 work centers, it won't take long for us to check your findings against the historical data, just to be sure.
Yeah, well, we've all seen how good that is.
Hey, I can only work with what I've got. What do you want me to do?
Okay, the important thing is that we have new methods to try. Let's not waste time pinning the blame on bad data. Let's get to work. Fueled by the energy of new ideas, we go to work, and the search goes quickly. So quickly, in fact, that what we discover makes me feel as though we've run ourselves straight into a wall.
This is it. Hello, Herbie.
The NCX-10? Are you sure this is a bottleneck?
Hey, there's some of the proof.
He points to the stacks of work-in-process inventory nearby, weeks of backlog according to the report Ralph and Stacy put together, and which we reviewed about an hour ago.
Well, we talked to the expediters. They say we're always waiting for parts from this machine. Supervisors say the same, and the guy who runs this area got himself a set of earplugs to keep him from going deaf from all the bitching he gets from everyone.
But this is supposed to be one of our most efficient pieces of equipment.
It is. It's the lowest cost, highest rate means we have of producing these particular parts.
So why is this a bottleneck?
Because this is the only one like it we got.
Yes, I know that. I stare at him until he explains.
See, this machine here is only about 2 years old. Before we installed it, we used other machines to do what it does. But this machine can do all the operations it used to take 3 different machines.
He tells me about how they used to process these parts using the 3 separate types of machines. In one typical instance, the process times per part were something like 2 minutes on the first machine, 8 minutes on the second, and 4 minutes on the third, a grand total of 14 minutes per part. But the new NCX-10 machine can do all 3 processes in 10 minutes per part. You're telling me we're saving 4 minutes per part. Doesn't that mean we're producing more parts per hour than we were? How come we've got so much inventory stacked up for this thing?
Well, with the old way, we had more machines. We had 2 of the first type, 5 of the second type, and 3 of the third type.
So you could do more parts, even though it took you longer per part. Then why did we buy the NCX-10?
Each of the other machines had to have a machinist to run it. The NCX-10 only needs 2 guys on it for setups. Like I said, it's the lowest cost way for us to produce these parts.
We do run this thing 3 shifts, don't we?
Well, we just started to again. It took a while to find a replacement for Tony, the setup guy on third shift who quit.
Oh, yeah. Man, Peach really did it to us that day.
Yeah.
Bob, how long does it take to train new people on this machine?
About 6 months. That's a big part of the problem, Al. We train somebody. After a couple of years, they can go elsewhere and make a few dollars more with somebody else. And we can't seem to attract anybody good with the wages we offer.
Well, why don't we pay more for people on this equipment?
Ah, the union. We'd get complaints, and the union would want us to up the pay grade for all the setup people.
Okay, so much for this. But that isn't all. The two of us walk to the other side of the plant, where Bob gives me a second introduction.
Meet Herbie number 2, the heat treat department.
This one looks more like what you might think of in terms of an industrial Herbie. It's dirty, it's hot, it's ugly, it's dull, and it's indispensable. Heat treat basically is a pair of furnaces, a couple of grimy, dingy steel boxes, the insides of which are lined with ceramic blocks. Gas burners raise the internal temperatures to the 1500 degree Fahrenheit range. Certain parts, after they've been machined or cold worked or whatever, at ordinary temperatures, can't be worked on anymore until they've been treated with heat for an extended period of time. Most often, we need to soften the metal, which becomes very hard and brittle during processing, so it can have more machining done to it. So the furnace operators put in the parts, from a dozen or less to a couple of hundred. Then they fire up the thing and cook the parts in there for a long time, anywhere from 6 hours to 16 hours. And afterwards, the parts always have to go through a further cool-down to air temperature outside the furnace. We lose a lot of time on this process. What's the problem here? We need bigger furnaces?
Well, yes and no. Most of the time, these furnaces are running half-empty.
How come?
It's the expediters who seem to cause the problem. They're always running over here and having us run 5 of this part or a dozen of that part just so they can have enough to assemble a shipment. So we end up having 50 parts wait while we heat-treat a handful. I mean, this operation is run like a barber shop. You take a number and stand in line.
So we're not running full batches?
Yeah, sometimes we are. But sometimes, even if we do a full batch in number, it's not enough to fill the furnace.
The batches are too small?
Or too big in size, and we have to run a second heat to handle the pieces that wouldn't fit in the first. It just never seems to work out. You know, a couple of years ago, there was a proposal to add a third furnace on account of the problems.
What happened to it?
It was killed at the division level. They wouldn't authorize the funds because of low efficiencies. Told us to use the capacity we got. Then maybe they'd talk expansion. Besides, there was all kinds of noise about how we gotta save energy and how another furnace would burn twice as much fuel and all that.
Okay, but if we filled the furnace every time, would we have enough capacity to meet demand?
I don't know. We never done it that way before.
Once upon a time, I had an idea for doing to the plant essentially what I did with the boys on the hike. I thought the best thing to do would be to reorganize everything so the resource with the least capacity would be first in the routings. All other resources would have gradual increases in capacity to make up for the statistical fluctuations passed on through dependency. Well, the staff and I meet right after Bob and I get back to the office, and it's pretty obvious, awfully damn quick, that my grand plan for the perfect unbalanced plant with Herbie in front is just not going to fly.
From a production standpoint, we can't do it.
There's just no way we can move even one Herbie, let alone 2, to the front of production. The sequence of operations has to stay the way it is. There's nothing we can do about it.
Okay. I already can see that.
We're stuck with a set of dependent events.
As I listen to them, I get that old, familiar feeling which comes whenever a lot of work and energy are about to go down the tubes. It's kind of like watching a tire go flat. Okay, if we can't do anything to change their position in the sequence, then maybe we can increase their capacities. We'll make them into non-bottlenecks.
But what about the step up in capacity from beginning to end?
We'll reorganize. We'll decrease capacity at the head of production and increase at each stage on through.
Oh, we're not just talking about moving people around. How can we add capacity without adding equipment? And if we're talking about equipment, we're getting ourselves into some major capital. The second furnace on heat treat and possibly a second NC machine? Brother, you're talking about megabucks.
The bottom line is that we don't have the money. If we think we can go to Peach and ask him for excess capacity for a plant that currently isn't making money in the middle of one of the worst years in the company's history, well, excuse my French, but we're out of our goddamned minds.